This is Bach to Bach, the podcast opening up the world of classical music, one beer at a time. And today, we are with the illustrious Group Muse. We all now know the phrase, there's an app for that. From those like Uber and Typorama to Workflow, there are apps that simplify our life or make life more accessible in ways that we never thought were possible. In 2013, the idea of Group Muse was born in Alston, Massachusetts, right outside Boston. Group Muse is a platform that connects audiences young and old with classical music by providing house concerts in cities across the United States and the world. Founded by Sam Bodkin, who at the time was working for the Boston Symphony Orchestra, Group Muse brings together friends through art. Group Muse has been featured in Time Magazine, The Wall Street Journal, Boston Globe, The Guardian, Dig Magazine, and many more, and is changing how we access and view classical music. We spoke with founder and CEO Sam Bodkin on the phone about the progress Group Muse has made and what is in store for the future of classical music.
Can you give us a little background on the founding of Group Muse and how you came up with this idea?
Sure. So Group Muse, to just give the listeners who aren't familiar with what the project is, just a brief overview, is a social network that directly connects classical musicians in the area to people who have living rooms in the area so that the community can organically generate its own chamber music house parties that we call Group Muses. And the idea behind a Group Muse is not merely to kind of demystify and make more accessible classical music. It's ultimately about creating plentiful and affordable and convenient opportunities for people to gather in the real world, offline, with their friends and their neighbors who are not yet their friends, to share something beautiful and profound and substantive, and to connect over that experience, over that shared experience. And so the origins of the idea come from, I guess, a few crucial moments in my own life over the course of the last decade. The first of which was I took a year off before college and traveled extensively using couchsurfing.com, which was kind of a forerunner to Airbnb, but it was free. You know, people would just let you crash on their couches because they wanted to get to know you and they wanted to, you know, proudly show off their town. And it was mind-blowing. It was revelatory, this experience. And it really opened me up to the possibility of the possibilities of social networking and the extent also to which people were willing to be generous with strangers for the sake of a cultural exchange. Mm. And I was very moved by the experience, but I didn't know exactly how that might manifest itself for years. So then a year later, in my freshman year of college, I am in the basement of a neighbor of mine who was a cellist himself, and he was working on Beethoven's Grosse Fuge string quartet, the Opus 133 late masterwork. And he wanted to show me a recording of the piece. So he put on the Emerson String Quartet's rendition. And it is, you know, to anyone who knows the piece, just it's such a gnarled, enigmatic, mega masterwork. And it's also completely different from what anyone might expect classical music to be if you're not familiar with the art form. And your associations with it are largely born of, you know, background music at cocktail parties and in, you know, films about royalty and in car commercials and whatnot. And this beast of a piece just challenged those preconceptions so deeply. And it's, I mean, it's just such a rocking masterwork. So I got a copy of this Emerson String Quartet performance and I listened to it 10 times a day for the next 2 weeks. And then I went to the local library, the Newton Free Library. Newton's a suburb of Boston. That's where I grew up. And I started just yanking stuff indiscriminately off the shelf, packing my iPod full of it, and listening to this great music, this universe of music that was just bottomless all the time, every day, hours a day. And I basically became like an overnight evangelist. Anyone who expressed even the faintest whiff of interest in this music, I would like make them a mix CD, and I'd say, tell me what you like, and I'll give you more in that vein. Because I guess it just occurred to me that at a moment that's lacking in beauty and substance and depth, there's this treasure trove of genius that stretches back 1,000 years, and it's all, you know, in the age of digital music, it's all so accessible. So I was just like, you know, I'd be like waiting in line for a coffee at Starbucks or something, and everyone else would be like pissed off because like, where's their latte? But for me, I would be listening to, you know, whatever, Beethoven 7 or a Shostakovich string quartet, and I'd just be on cloud 9. And so it was just so I became completely obsessed, and I knew within like 6 months of that first conversion moment that I was going to devote my life to the expansion of the audience for this music. So then I fell in with a group of musicians in, I guess it was my junior year of college. They would gather in this apartment in Alston, Massachusetts, which is a neighborhood of Boston, a pretty gritty neighborhood of Boston. And these were a bunch of New England Conservatory musicians, some of whom have gone on to have, you know, among the most celebrated careers of all young classical musicians. So super virtuosi, but also just like awesome people who really knew how to get down. And so they would have these like boozy nights where they'd play, you know, a Brahms piano quartet. And then we'd all like drink together. And I was the only non-musician there. But for me, it was a uniquely essential experience, because I didn't even realize that there could be such a profound breakdown between the distinction between, you know, enrichment, I guess you could say, and enjoyment. Basically, what I mean by that is that it was like going to a museum and having your world expanded by eternal masterworks of art, but then you're also just like partying and you're laughing and you're flirting and you're doing that whole thing. And so it's like the moment is so vital, but there's also this grandeur to it. And it was just, it was just such a unique thing. And I thought to myself, largely inspired by the couchsurfing experience, man, anyone who's got a floor could have this. And so that's kind of where the idea came from. Basically, that there is this inherently social character to classical music, because it is experienced in real time, in real space, which means you've got to do it with other people that are alongside you. And yet at present, the social character of concert hall culture, I think, is really what's holding it back. People, it just doesn't seem like a vital scene that young people want to boogie with. And so basically the idea was to use the social character of classical music as its greatest asset in a moment that really, I think, is lacking for meaningful, positive, vital social experiences. And so to turn that from a liability into a strength, the social character of classical music performance. And then, you know, it's like, this is the social network era. And so it made just too much sense in the world to use the internet to create that. So that's kind of like, that was the kernel of the idea. That was like late junior year, early senior year in college. And so I graduated in 2012. That summer, I worked for the Boston Symphony Orchestra at Tanglewood with these ideas just kind of marinating. And then come September, I moved back in with my folks outside Boston, and I just started working on the project, talking to anyone and everyone who would take a meeting with me and listen to me. And the response, the feedback was just really positive. And so that was really encouraging. And then in January of 2013, we had the first group muse. And at that group muse, I sort of like laid out this idea. And I said, who wants to host the next one? And like six people said, yeah, I'll host the next one. And so we had one in 2 weeks, and then we had one in 1 week. And then we were having them basically weekly within a couple of months. And then I was joined by my first co-founder, Ezra Weller, who I went to elementary school with, actually. And then I was joined in September of 2013. We were joined by Kyle Schmalzi, who was my best friend and my roommate at the time, is just a computer wizard. And so he came on as the third member of the founding team. And once once the trio fused, things really started taking off. Within a few months after Kyle joining, we were having like 4 group muses a week in Boston. And then like we topped out that year at like 9 group muses a week, 10 group muses a week in Boston.
Wow.
So then I moved to New York in September of 2014. Kyle had moved to San Francisco a couple months earlier. And that was our first big national expansion move because we took group muse with us. And so to this day, by far our most active communities are Boston, New York, and San Francisco. We have actually, a very regular and reliable community in Seattle, though it's less booming, but it's a wonderful community and a great bunch of people.
How do you see Seattle as far as its engagement? Like, it's up and coming, starting to grow.
Well, no, not exactly. So the thing is, Seattle's funny because Seattle is a community that's basically as old as New York, but it's just never really boomed. It's just been slow and steady and reliable. So we have, like, I would say on average between 1 and 3 group muses a week in Seattle, occasionally more, very occasionally fewer. And it's just like the community is in a groove, and eventually we do hope to double, triple, quadruple the activity there. But it started under somewhat unusual circumstances, because it didn't start with a founder in town, like pounding the pavement. It started because actually one woman just reached out randomly from the internet, Emma Lynn, and she's like, I love this idea. I want to create it in Seattle. And she just put in a lot of work and got it to a sustainable place. And so it is eventually going to be at the level of activities of, say, our other cities, our other major cities. But we don't feel a huge rush on that. The community is happy there and it's just kind of cruising. What we're really trying to do right now is figure out how to start other communities with a bang remotely, because we've had many group meetings all over the country and over the world as well. But creating a sustainable community is really the crucial thing. We need to have a city that is group musing 3, 4, 5, 6 times a week, because only then can it really fulfill, I think, its social potential, its ultimate potential, which is not just as a vehicle for classical music to express itself in new ways. It's really about creating a vital and ongoing social scene that grows over time, but stays tightly knit. Mm. And so that's what we're trying. That's what we're about to launch in Los Angeles. We've got like 20 group muses on the books for launch month, which is next month. This is March. And so that's really exciting for us, because none of us live in Los Angeles, but we were just there a couple weeks ago, and we met with a crew of incredibly devoted and energized new hosts who are going to be hosting, if not every month, then every quarter. And that's really all we need to grow a community, and to not just grow it, but do it in a healthful and durable way. So that's where it's at right now.
Do you feel that as group muse continues to grow in these cities, does it reach a point where it becomes almost self-sustaining, where you've beat the pavement enough, where there's, you know, the word is out, there is already a vibrant community surrounding it, or is it, does it need that? Obviously, you guys in these big cities in New York and San Fran, to have a full-time person there is crucial.
But honestly. Honestly, they are fully self-sustaining in Boston, New York, and San Francisco. Like, we no longer are recruiting hosts. Wow. We're no longer recruiting musicians. People just hear about it, sign up to host every week. Tons of new hosts every week. Tons of returning hosts every week. And musicians now, I mean, for musicians, this is a pretty major source of income, but also personal, like, creative satisfaction, because they can create the programs themselves. You have a really attentive audience, most of whom are young folks who are not familiar with classical music. Sure. So it's like, you know, when you perform The Death and the Maiden or some comparable warhorse, they're not thinking to themselves, oh, I prefer the Emerson, I prefer the Takash or Quartetto Italiano or something. They're thinking to themselves like, whoa, I did not know music could be this intense and dynamic.
Yeah.
And so That has never been an issue for us, finding musicians who are down. And so, yeah, it really is self-sustaining. I mean, the full-time person in San Francisco is Kyle, but he's our web dude. Like, he builds the website, everything tech, that's him. So he doesn't really have time. You know, he's preoccupied. That's a huge job.
Right.
And so he's not building the community particularly actively. I'm the full-time person in New York, and I'm doing, you know, business development, partnerships and all that other kind of stuff. And so I go to a couple group muses every week just as a matter of course, but I'm not like actively recruiting musicians and hosts at all anymore in New York. It's just carrying itself at this point.
That's amazing. And so like, and you're just going back to what you're saying about those audience members who aren't musicians, aren't classical musicians, whether as or usually classical attendees. What have you seen through Group Muse as far as the audience demographic growing? Is it growing more and more towards musicians, or is it really kind of engaging that non-musician, that non-classical listener, and getting them excited about it?
Oh, I mean, it's I would say at Group Muse, most of the people there are not regular classical music listeners. They might be a regular Group Muse attendees, but you know, 70% of the people who come to Group Muse are millennials, you know, born in the 80s or the 90s, and a majority of those are not regular serious classical music listeners, but they find themselves listening to more live classical music at this point than any other form of performed music, because it's like, it's just their social life now. It's like, it's a Friday night, like, let's see what Group Muse is up to. And hey, there's one happening right down the street from me, why not? And of course, they love the music. We also go to great lengths to make sure that every group, not only does it have great music that's well performed, but also it's very digestible. So we have 2 20 or 25 minute chunks of music, and that's it. Really, never more than 45 minutes of music in the entire evening. And we don't ask that people sit for more than 25 minutes at a time, because these are new listeners, and like, we would much rather keep them wanting more than getting fidgety and having too much. That's that.
How do you track the analytics of the crowds going to each of these group muses? And do you compile these sets of data as well?
We do it for growth purposes, trying to figure out like, you know, where are our most active communities, where are communities that need, a push here and then. But we don't go crazy on the analytics stuff. I mean, we definitely are not data miners. And
right.
And we're doing, you know, we basically do what we need to do to understand how well we're doing at our job.
With musicians, so when the group music concert happens and the musicians come to the home and go to the host, are there set parameters on what programming is allowed to be used? Do you guys try to avoid 20th century music? Do you try to avoid, you know, early music? Are there any parameters as far as the programming?
Yeah. So our one sort of programmatic stipulation is that at least half of the music be quote unquote standard rep, very loosely defined. And for us, that basically means like, has it been in circulation for 75 years or more?
Okay.
So we've had stuff that's 1,000 years old played at Group Muses. And we've also had, you know, and that stretches all the way to basically Bar Talk, and even more recent than, you know, Benjamin Britten, Samuel Barber, that kind of stuff. It's quote unquote standard concert hall rep, like I say, somewhat loosely defined. So that's half of the program. The other half of the program can be anything the players want. It often is two halves classical, just because that's what they want to play. But we've also had, for the second half, new music, of course. We've had jazz. We've had Brazilian piano pop. We've had actually like Guns N' Roses arrangements for string quartet, the whole shebang. And the reason why we have that first programmatic stipulation of half needing to be standard concert hall rep is because it's a really powerful way for us to guarantee the quality of the musical experience as we scale across the country. We're a tiny team, and yet we're putting on, you know, between 20 and 30 concerts every week. And so we want to be able to know that whatever is happening at a Group Muse, at least some of the music is time tested, because we don't want to be the ones to say this is good music, this is bad music. But we do believe that if something has been around for 100 years or 250 years, that attests to an inherent core of quality that has reverberated throughout the ages. I mean, there's a reason why someone in the world today says, yo, that idea that Chopin had, you know, 150 years ago, that thing still has legs. Like, you know, that needs to be shared with contemporary audiences. So, yeah, that's why we do it the way that we do it.
We also saw on your website, which we got really excited about, the idea of group muse at work and the concept of bringing it into the workplace, and especially how you guys put an emphasis on this is not background music. These people are coming to you, and this is going to be a performance. Can you talk to our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, so group muse at work is a sort of a more marginal offering of ours. We think that there's huge potential there, but our sort of flagship experience and the most important part of what we do, we believe, is the living room scene. And so we do put on the occasional group muse at work for corporate offices. And for those, we charge corporate prices. It's really an effort to generate some revenue because the living room scene doesn't actually, well, not surprisingly, is not particularly lucrative because the vast majority of the money goes to the musicians. Sure. But not only do we think that it has a lot of potential from a business perspective, and the reason why we haven't focused on it is just because the team is too small, but we eventually will. We also think it really does have a pretty profound potential in terms of delivering on our mission, because people spend the majority of their lives at work, and their work community is basically their daytime community. Mm-hmm. And this is just such a lightweight way to imbue the workaday world of cubicles and fluorescent lights with beauty and inspiration and fire. So we've done them at Google, we've done them at Kickstarter, we've done them at Palantir Technologies. But you know, it's still, I would say, in its infancy as an initiative, even if it's been around for a while. We've been doing it for a few years now. But we haven't gotten really serious about basically building a sales pipeline. It's a hard sell because it's so unusual, and it'll just take a lot of deliberate effort to get there, but we think that it'll be worth it someday.
Awesome. And then the other event that you guys offer are Group Muse Nights Out.
Yeah.
And that's only in New York City currently, correct?
Actually, no. We just started in San Francisco, and we're hoping to bring it to Boston as well. The first real night out in San Francisco is next week. So it's fresh, you know, hot off the press. And the idea there is that we've got this big, vibrant, new crowd of young listeners, and what we believe will eventually constitute the patronage base for classical music moving into the 21st century. And these institutions just, you know, they're doing a great job and important work keeping alive this venerable tradition of classical music, but it's just really hard for these somewhat inflexible institutions to cater to the tastes and styles of young people, and we're really good at that. So we are, for Nights Out, we basically will get a stack of tickets from Orchestra of St. Luke's, for example, as a partner in New York that we love working with, and we will sell them to our audience at a discounted rate, and get, you know, 100 young butts in seats for an evening of, you know, glorious music in a real concert hall setting. Yeah. So Group Muse Nights Out, it's just a concert that would already be happening, but what we can do with it is we can use our crowd-building tool to get together a group of people. Maybe they'll go together, maybe they'll get drinks afterward, but they'll get into the concert hall and see what it's about in the big house.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's in there. So I'm excited to see how San Francisco turns out. That's awesome you're launching that there.
Me too, yeah.
So to the listeners, classical and not, what are some of your personal favorite? We talked about the Grosse Fugue. Some of your personal favorite classical pieces to get just people amped up.
So I often say that my four favorite pieces are the Grosse Fugue, the Beethoven Violin Concerto, Mozart's Marriage of Figaro, and Mozart's Clarinet Quintet. But, you know, that's just sort of historically, I am always listening to a lot of different stuff. And I like a lot of different stuff.
That's huge. So, and is there one 20th century piece that really calls out to you?
The Janáček string quartets, I believe, to be like the greatest string quartets of the 20th century, the greatest chamber works of the 20th century, kind of, by my mind, you know, without qualification. Especially Intimate Letters, but both of them. I mean, I go nuts for Janáček. So yeah, that's an easy one.
My music history teacher in college, like his doctorate was all about Janáček. That's what the dissertation was based on Janáček's life. And so it was composer I before that really did not know much about, but Explorer were just unbelievable.
Yeah, he's the best.
Sam, it's been awesome having you. Before we go, we do have our Bach to Bach quiz.
Lay it on me.
Lay it on you. So three questions. Maddie will say the question number. I will say the question. You say the first thing that comes to the top of your head. You
ready?
Sounds good. Yeah.
All right, here we go. Number one.
All right. What beer best describes your personality?
I guess I'd say Lagunitas.
And which one would say?
Little Something.
Little Something. Yeah, Little Something. Yeah. Something Ale. I ruined it.
Take it from me, man. Number two.
Okay, so what superpower would you be dying to have?
I would most want to be virtuosic at every instrument that I pick up and a virtuosic composer capable of putting whatever is happening in my head on paper.
Well, so actually, here's a question before we go on to the next question. You are not a musician, so what instrument do you want to learn?
I mean, piano, just because it's like a meta instrument. It's like the mega instrument, the ultimate instrument. So if there was one, and I can barely read music, but every time there's a piano around, I climper on it a bit. But I mean, if I could single-handedly create the Waldstein or the Wanderer Fantasy or Schubert's B flat, I mean, I would be happy for the rest of eternity. Just playing a piano on a desert island.
I think the word "climper" is my new favorite verb.
That's funny. My grandma used to say that when I would climper on the piano, she'd say, "Stop climpering."
I love that. That's my new favorite word.
All right, last one.
Number three.
All right, so who would you want any celebrity, and let's say from the history of time, who would you want to attend a group muse event?
Thomas Pynchon, the author of Gravity's Rainbow. Who is arguably my favorite human being in history, besides maybe Mozart, a super genius, still alive, living in New York. It's in fact possible he might go to a group muse someday, but no one even really knows what he looks like. So maybe he's actually gone under a pseudonym, and I didn't even know. But that seems unlikely because
let's hope and dream. Let's say that.
Yeah, let's hope and dream. Exactly.
Sam, where can people find you on the World Wide Web?
Groupmuse.com.
There it is.
And then and same handle on social media?
Yes, at Groupmuse.
Beautiful. Sam, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for taking your time.
So much.
Sam Bodkin of Groupmuse. You can find them at Groupmuse.com. Sam,
it was a pleasure.
Thank you.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
See you later.
One of the ways Kevin and I find inspiration for linking the world of classical music and beer come from our occasional strolls through the paradise that is Westmere Beverage in our hometown of Guildhall in New York. When we're home to visit our parents, we'll always take a detour to peruse beer choices that span coast to coast, and we'll pull bottles off the shelves that could offer us that link, whether through a name, a style, or some other factor. It was here we ran across the Dark Muse Imperial Stout, brewed by Worthy Brewing Company out in beautiful Bend, Oregon. So due west of Eugene and through the Willamette Forest, it's a place I drove through many years ago, but the memory is still as vivid as yesterday, and it's tough to imagine a more picturesque environment to brew in. After we researched it a bit, we realized it was lucky we ran across it, as it's only made on a rotating basis, and the batch we came across was made in 2015. At the first pour, the consistency reminded us of Guinness, of all things, although the flavor had much more weight to it. Then came the caramel and rich malty flavor, and on a cold day, there's not much more to ask for. It's heavier than it looks, and for all the smoothness, we couldn't say we would take down another one immediately afterwards. Some other lucky reviewers have mentioned a taste of chocolate at the end, but we weren't that fortunate when we got to the bottom of our glasses. A great drink for the winner, but with the sun shining outside, the surroundings didn't really feel that right. You can find out more about Worthy Brewing at worthybrewing.com or drop by Bend, Oregon and say hello. Again, Dark Muse Imperial Stout is on a rotational brewing, so if you see a bottle, it's worth it to take it home.
Okay, embarrassing story time. When I was in high school, specifically 10th grade, I took part in a Renaissance feast. Now, this wasn't the embarrassing part, because it was an amazing event put on my school, where we would dress in period costumes, eat massive feasts, dance, and as part of the chamber ensemble, we were providing the entertainment. However, the embarrassing part was the purple velvet dress that I decided to wear. However, I will admit, I did make it look really good. But one thing high school showed me was how much I loved chamber music. And after speaking with Sam Bodkin about Group Muse, it made me reignite that love that chamber music really brings to my soul. So after trying to find a piece of music that would be perfectly fitting for this episode, I came across the Schubert Quintet in C major. Now a quintet obviously is five players, but what's really special about this and why I love it so much is that there are two cellos involved. Now this piece was completed in 1828, just 2 months before Franz Schubert's death. The first two movements of this quintet is a massive, massive undertaking. The first movement alone takes over 20 minutes to perform, and the second movement coming in at just under 15 minutes. Now as a quintet, this is a massive amount of music to learn and master and then perform. But this third movement in the quintet completely changes direction and remind me of those Renaissance times. A lot of open strings and resonating sounds bring back that feel that is the core of Renaissance music. And this movement is a scherzo, which is a fast-paced dance. The Schubert Quintet in C major is an essential piece of repertoire for both performers and listeners to have under their belt. Thank you. Just finished another episode of Bach to Bach. Grab a beer, listen to some music, and cheers. Subscribe to Bach to Bach on iTunes and follow us on social media at Bach to Bach.